Have you ever caught yourself remembering something vividly, only to discover it never happened quite that way? When Charles Fernyhough's 7-year-old son asked about the first fish he ever caught, this seemingly innocent question sparked a profound realization. Our most cherished memories aren't faithful recordings, but creative reconstructions assembled anew each time we remember. This revolutionary understanding transforms how we view our very identities. Memory doesn't work like a video camera, dutifully recording and storing our experiences for later playback. Instead, it's a dynamic, creative process happening in the present moment, drawing on fragments distributed across different brain regions. Each recall becomes a fresh version of the original event, colored by our current circumstances, emotional state, and accumulated experiences. This explains why memories can feel so vivid, yet prove so unreliable. We're not retrieving something fully formed, but creating something new that combines sensory details, spatial information, emotional responses, and narrative understanding. Getting lost in a once familiar city reveals profound truths about memory's mechanisms. Returning to Cambridge after 17 years, landmarks appearing like ghosts while once routine shortcuts feel alien, demonstrates how memory fundamentally works. Navigation relies on specialized hippocampal cells. Place cells fire at specific locations, head direction cells act as internal compasses, and grid cells divide space into equal units. This neural GPS explains why we often remember through locations rather than chronology, and why getting lost feels so unsettling. It's not just geographical confusion, but a disruption of how we organize experience. This connection between navigation and memory explains why medieval memory techniques used spatial organization, memory palaces, to enhance recall, tapping into the brain's natural tendency to organize information spatially, a principle still used by modern memory champions. A forgotten cigar ash tray or a Madeleine cake dipped in tea can trigger extraordinary memory responses. When medical student Sylvia found her grandmother's ashtray, the smell triggered not a coherent narrative, but powerful emotions disconnected from her life story. This mirrors Proust's famous Madeleine moment, though with a distinction. Sensory triggers don't immediately transport us to specific memories, but initiate a process of reconstruction. Smell possesses unique neurological properties, explaining its mnemonic power. Unlike other sensory signals that pass through the thalamus, olfactory signals travel directly to the hippocampus. This direct pathway explains why smell-triggered memories reach further back in time and feel more emotional than those from sight or sound. Andy Warhol harnessed this power by wearing a cologne for exactly 3 months before retiring it, creating a scent museum he could revisit to access specific memories. This interplay between voluntary and involuntary memory remains complex. Sometimes excessive effort impedes remembering, while chance encounters with forgotten scents can transport us more vividly than intentional reminiscence. Why can most of us remember little before age 4? This remarkable amnesia of childhood isn't because infants can't form memories. Studies show even 2-month-olds can retain associations for days. The explanation involves developing autonoetic consciousness, which places you at the center of your memories. Young children often recall events accurately, but don't recognize themselves as the authors of these memories. As self-awareness develops, we experience memories from within rather than observing them externally, explaining why early memories often appear from an observer perspective. Research shows younger children recall more pre-3 memories than adults, suggesting early memories become inaccessible rather than lost. Words provide new ways to encode experiences, with earliest memories typically emerging after acquiring relevant vocabulary. Parents who elaborate during conversations about past events, providing context, location, and emotional significance, help children develop richer memory narratives that persist into adolescence. As Virginia Woolf noted, these early fragment memories possess a purity later memories lack. Memory is fundamentally social and collaborative. When remembering together, we actively shape each other's recollections. Relationships involve negotiating shared memories. Couples must encourage their memories to make friends, creating an agreed representation of their past. As Rebecca Solnit observes, a happy love is a single story, while failing relationships feature competing narratives. Sibling dynamics differ. Without pressure for unified narratives, siblings often maintain divergent memories of childhood. After her father's death, Fiona and her siblings spent days reminiscing, revealing dramatically different perspectives on shared experiences. Two forces drive memory: accuracy and coherence. Emotionally charged memories become less negotiable. Challenges to them feel like attacks on identity. The person making a claim on my family story is telling me I'm not who I think I am. Research shows our susceptibility to memory influence. About half of study participants develop detailed memories of fictional events shown in doctored childhood photos. While collaborative remembering helps couples fill memory gaps, it can also incorporate others' errors and sometimes reduce factual recall in groups. Memory serves both past and future. When preparing a talk, I don't need perfect recall of previous lectures, but rather the ability to synthesize past experiences into something new. This reveals memory's true evolutionary purpose, not simply recording history, but helping navigate what lies ahead. Neuroimaging confirms this dual function. Imagining future scenarios activates the same brain regions as remembering past events, particularly the hippocampus and medial prefrontal cortex. Our emotional biases operate similarly in both temporal directions. We tend toward optimism about the future and retain positive future simulations longer than negative ones. Memory deficits impair future thinking. Profoundly amnesic patients create sparse imaginary scenarios when asked to envision novel experiences, like standing on a beach, lacking spatial complexity, sensory detail, and emotional depth. Yet remembering everything would be catastrophic. Borgia's character Funes the Memorious demonstrates how perfect recall prevents pattern recognition. Real cases like Jill Price, who remembers every day since age 14, show the burden of excessive memory. Our brains evolved a more efficient system that prioritizes patterns over details. What appear as memory errors, bias, and suggestibility are actually features of a healthy system, integrating information from multiple sources. Though our memories blend fact and fiction, they remain precious. Embracing memory's constructed nature is liberating. We're all storytellers, editing our memories as knowledge and emotions evolve. My grandmother Martha, at 93, focused her life story on key pre-war events with remarkable consistency. Her reunion with 94-year-old Sadie, unseen for nearly 80 years, enhanced her recall as they shared school memories. New technologies like SenseCam, a wearable camera capturing images automatically, are transforming remembrance. Amnesia patients reviewing SenseCam images remembered about 80% of recorded events versus 49% with written diaries, with retention lasting months. The technology's strength lies in its indiscriminate recording, triggering what Martin Conway calls Proustian moments, vivid recollections sparked by tiny details. While memories can be remarkably accurate, their narrative structure reveals their function. Like good reportage, memories can be truthful despite being structured as stories. These may be fictions, but they're our fictions. The stories about our past create the selves we become. Memory's true power lies not in perfect preservation, but in meaningful connection between our past and future selves.